Major Seppings, Reel 11.
Yes, they were, as I say, Mount Hood is communist. I think they were mainly white flag. White flag and red flag were distinct, or tried to be distinct. The white flag always considered themselves as political opponents to any government. And they were not like the red flag, who considered themselves to be militants, who had armed people acting for them. But by the time that it got to about 1949, there was no question of any politics being involved, because the Burma government wouldn't accommodate these people. They didn't want to hear from them. They had no say in the running of the government, so they armed themselves. And they tried to set up in the Arakan a separate, not a state so much, as state control over all these towns that were in the Akyab district. Well, I went to see Mantu on several occasions. He met me very nicely, entertained me. I tried to talk him into doing something. I had assurances. I was a bit, as I say, still young. This is 1949, so I was 28 years old. I still had a belief in the Burmese government and what was told to me, and what I was, when I decided to go see Mantu, I went to see him on my own, and nobody knew on the very first occasion. Then I went down to Rangoon and I saw the Deputy Prime Minister, and I said, look, he's an old college friend of mine. The Deputy Prime Minister was a university friend of mine as well. He knew Mantu, he's American. And I said, look, the best thing I can do is to parley with these people, try and get them to surrender their arms. But you've got to give them some alternative. I mean, they've either got to be recruited into the army or the police, or given some arrangement made where they can sort of come out into the open. And he said, well, their political views are so close to ours, there's no point in really trying to talk them into doing anything. He said, we are a socialist government where there's no room for the communists. We won't have it. But if you can induce Mantu to surrender his arms, and have sufficient arms to, say, protect himself without being aggressive, then fair enough. We won't, and you needn't launch operations against them, because I was operating against them quite rigidly. No Mantu, not being an army officer, didn't have this experience. He didn't do any aggressive. It was under him, actually, that all these towns were taken over. He didn't lead any operations. I was leading all the time. So I said, okay. And eventually, as I say, I met Mantu again and said, look, the idea is that we shan't harass you anymore, because we were mortaring his village and areas where we knew that his men were. We got the Burma army to come over and spread fire machine gun a particular area that it was. And I said, you know, we'll keep on doing this, because you keep ambushing these passenger boats and what have you, and killing these people for no reason at all. He said, well, we're trying to get supplies off these boats. So what do you mean? Well, he said, kill the skipper, at least the boat gets out of control, we can raid this. The boat take supplies of rice, and which is very short of. Anyway, cut a long story short, he sent 100 men, about 100 men, with their rifles. When they arrived, of course, they realized that a large number of the rifles were old. Didn't work, but it was a token surrender with inefficient weapons. There were some good, three or four rifle stems. And for a time, we had to set up a camp for all these chaps, food, accommodation, and whatever. And thought, oh, success. So I reported that this had happened. Next thing, I get orders from the government in Rangoon to arrest them all for prospective trial. Of course, this was a huge letdown. I assured Mantu that once they surrendered and once we had sort of documented them and what have you, we'd send them back, you see, or try and absorb them into, say, the military police forces or something like that. And of course, after that, Mantu was my sworn enemy. He thought lightly come down. And in a way, I felt that the Birmingham was let me down. And I was very, very strong in my criticism when I went down to conferences, by which time I was the Deputy Inspector General of Police, the number two policeman in Burma, a very important position. And I used to attend cabinet meetings and make my views very well known. Openly used to accuse the Prime Minister of duplicity and things like that. So we come to 1950, January 1950, when in that time I'm asked to produce all my reports on military operations against the insurgents for the benefit of the Deputy Inspector General of Police and Rangers, a chap called Percy Loder, who asked me to do, with a view to being given an honor. So I do that, they send it down to him. Prior to the honors appearing in the honors list for Burma, independence anniversary list, the signal was sent to me asking me if I had. Was prepared to denounce my British nationality and take on Burmese citizenship, in which case I would qualify for the knighthood that was proposed to give me. It was 3C3, they call it, which meant it was Sir somebody. I sent a signal back saying no. It was my plan to leave Burma to follow another career. So be it, so it didn't appear. The honours list appeared, and much to my surprise, I was awarded the Republic Police Silver Medal. Which apparently was the top police award. Looked at it was a bit of amusement. Anyway, that was it. And about February, after the anniversary celebrations, I went down the rank and I saw Ulu, the Prime Minister, and said, "Look, I think I'm going to ask you to terminate my services." And I said, "My wife and I don't go think about it. There's no point, there's no future for us here, not for her. You've got to know me now." I said, "I'm not the Burmese." I said, "I cannot wear a sarong." I said, "My command of the Burmese language is liberty." I said, "My whole life has been totally Western. My father's an Englishman. My brother's out of the country, he's in England. And I said, I don't think my future lies here." And apart from which, I said, I've been shot at so many times in the Arakan, leading these armed forces against the insurgents. I said, there's nothing that my wife would gain by me being killed. There's no compensation, arrangements, and what have you. It's a very loose arrangement, I understand, between you and the British government, through the ambassador, to retain me, having retained me, whilst this trial was going on, and whilst Usaw was, when he was going to be hanged, he was hanged in 1949. And I said, everything's over now. I think that I'm risking my neck too much. I must think of my wife and my two children. I said, my wife is either blonde or blue. I think she can't stay in Burma. How could she be expected to act like a Burmese woman? Neither can I. My views are totally alien to. I have a great sympathy for Burmese. I said, I have no Burmese blood in me. I said, I've got Thai blood in me. I must sort of resign. Okay, he said, we're very sorry. He said, because we totally rely on you to have kept the Arakan under control. You brought law and order into the whole place. Okay, fine. Now, at that particular time, we, the Arakan, especially the Western Arakan, where you had the Muslims who were revolting against the Burmese government. They were known as the Mujahid. They were being denied first-class citizens and rights, and they always been considered second-class citizens. So they formed terrorist organizations. Now, they were very well trained, because a lot of those chaps who were then in revolt and harassing British forces, the Burmese army forces, were all members of V Force, another organization that was brought in, where they used these chaps as fighting units, and a lot of them were there. I had a lot of skirmishes with them. In fact, I had one or two letters from the leader, one leader, Shukru, who knew me, or heard of me, I was in the Gurkha and what have you, and he was a want of some people, wrote me several notes saying, "Sir, go away from this country, we have no fight with you. We are fighting the Burmese government, we know you, who you are, and no point in us trying to kill each other." In fact, I killed him. I went to see him, he surrounded us. I went up to this place, and we were told that there was a small force of these Mujahids there. In fact, they turned out to be a very large force, and they surrounded us. And we happened to, in India and Burma, they do have these fish tanks where they push, have their own fish. You can't go and fish there, but it always belongs to somebody. Well, fortunately, there was this fish tank next to a government bungalow where I took my men. I had two section of Burma Rifles and a section of police, and we went to try and sort out this lot, but we found that there were very large numbers, well armed. They had a hill feature where they were firing on us from there. So we took refuge in this fish pond, and it was Shukru's men. He was in command of this lot, and when he heard that I was there, he shouted out at night, I remember. We were so close that you lit a cigarette, you got a bullet shot at you. We managed to kill about six when they attacked us, and then there was a bit of a laugh. And then he shouted out to me and he said, "Sam, come and let us meet. I don't want to bring my men. We will kill you all. You're not sufficiently armed. You haven't got enough men there. And this is totally ridiculous. Now, first thing tomorrow morning, I'll come out of the jungle and you come out of that fish pond where he's taking refuge." I said, "Okay," shouted out to him. I said, "Right, Akbaja." I said, "No arms." "Yes, no arms." "Right." I had a 30-30 carbine. And I thought, I didn't trust this funny man. Sure enough, when I came out there, he was armed with a Sten. He opened up, he missed me, and I shot him dead with my carbine. We were about 50 feet apart, eh? And that, of course, the fact that I killed their leader was enough for them to all stop. And I managed to bring this lot out. Had they decided to attack me, I don't think we'd have been able to hold them back. Now, at that particular area, there was a lot of rice smuggling going on from Burma via the Naaf River to East Pakistan, East Bengal. And a lot of people were mixed up in it. I was doing my very best to try and stop it, but the Burma customs, the Burmese, the Burma Navy were all mixed up in this lot. And one of the actions we had was at the mouth of the Naaf River, where I was coming out in a Burma Navy motor launch, and we got fired on from the bank, and the pilot was killed. I made the ML go towards the bank and start opening fire on these people while they managed to stop us. Anyway, subsequently, there was me stopping smuggling as best I could. I had an Anglo-Burmese assistant who had a record of bribery, all the rest of it, a chap called Eric Shaw. till now, didn't know what to do with this chap because he was in another area and he was again suspected of taking bribes. Till now, when I went down to see him and tried to do it on other matters, I said, look, I don't know what to do with this fellow, sure. Till now, though, was very, very nice man. He you know, he didn't want any British police officer. He was totally anglicized, that man. He was a very fair man. He said, look, I don't know what to do with this man, sure, for God's sake. And he said, he's got mixed up again. There's been an inquiry and what have you. He's back to his old tricks again. Can you have him in the Air Academy? Give him a job somewhere. I said, what rank is he? He said, an inspector. Okay. All right.
He said his wife is a nice person.
So I said, okay. But I said, I'm not going to replace him with somebody like, you know, he's not going to stay in Akihan. He's got to be out. I said, I might be able to replace him with somebody who's out in the other towns. Anyway, Shaw turned up. And I sent him out to a place called Pongajun. And his wife now and again comes into Akihan, sees my young wife, and says, oh, we're having a terrible time, and we have no friends there. And the boss has sent Eric out there, and he's always on different operations and what have you. So Pam says to me, oh, poor thing, you know, she's got no friends there. She said, a lot of, there's quite a reasonable British community in Akihan. A lot of the customs people there, Anglo-Burmese, and this girl, Mrs. Shaw, was Anglo-Burmese. She knew people. I want to join in the social life and what have you, so I must have got a judgment. I managed to get an inspector who was a native of this place. I said, look, do you fancy a change with Mr. Shaw? Take over there. And he said, oh, yes, sir. Oh, fine. Okay. As long as it was green. So I posted him to Akihan. Now, when I was promoted DIG, the Akihanese wouldn't accept a Burmese officer. And there was no officer in the Akihan district that was sufficiently senior to take over as DSP. I'd become a Deputy Inspector General of Police then. So I suggested to Rangoon that I promote this guy, acting district superintendent of police, and put him in charge. And I did that. Now, Eric Shaw knew that he was going to be there for a short time. And this penchant for bribery and corruption, he got tied up with the customs. He was friendly with all the boys in the customs. They all knew each other. And he was behind, not behind, but party to the smuggling that took place from the Burma side to the East Bengal side. And what that man was doing was getting his share and my share, which I never saw. So he was getting a whack both sides. The DIG share, and then his share. And although I was making quite a lot of headway capturing these boats, an armada would go across 10, 12 strong, huge barges. And they had, the very first time I went out in the Burma Navy launch, there were two boats that were crossing, and we suspected that they were carrying rice bags. When we fired and tried to stop them, all of a sudden, the bows went up like that, and they went away. They had grey marine engines, twin engines, fitted on them. All the part of the world, they were just disappearing. But anyway, this was all I learned when I came back to England, was I met the customs officer who was in charge then. He had taken a lot of money. And what happened was, when 1950 came along, I'd arranged for passages for ourselves, myself, my wife, and children, to leave Rangoon in March. It was the 20th of March. I went down to Rangoon, all the kit and what have you, we didn't have an awful lot. I then went to the Inspector General's office. He was an old fat Burman called Barma, and he said, well, then, the Prime Minister hasn't really agreed to your departure. And I said, what are you talking about? I'm leaving in a couple of days' time. he said, I'll have a word with him. And then he said, look, we've got some things to sort out to do with the Aung San assassination or whatever. Let your wife do it, and you can follow up, you know, and just delay your passage. And I said, all right, fine. What's this all to do about Aung San? He said, well, I don't know. The Prime Minister wants to discuss things with you. So on the 20th, get down to the airport in Minyogon. First thing that made me suspicious, they're searching my children. Body search, women, husbands. And then my wife had Pam had a body search. I have it. What are you looking for? Well, we've got little things like lead rings made for the kids, rubies, gold. My wife had a bracelet, might be worth anything, rubies, fellow rubies, cheap rubies. We didn't go in for jewelry. My wife was very little jewelry, never does. But what the hell? Anyway, see you off on the plane. Go back to headquarters. I get in touch with the Assistant Deputy Inspector General. He's a very nice chap. I say, look, my wife is body safe. He said, Carl, I'm going to tell you there's something serious that happened. He said, it might happen this morning. Yeah. All right. Yeah. He said, well, take a pew, you know. Next thing, this man who is the inspector discussing a case with me when the raffle tattle tattle took place on the 19th, Moitra, had a chap called Jordan, an Indian sub-inspector. Moitra came up and he said, sir, I'm terribly sorry, I have a warrant for your arrest. I said, phew, am I arrest? On what grounds? Being involved in smuggling tricks in the American. And he said, the more serious charge of being involved in murdering 13 Muslim women in an operation you carried out at the mouth of the Nile. I said, I don't believe this. Look, I said, Moshe, you stay here with Udo. I'm going up to see Lewin. He was in the Secretariat, he was then Minister in charge of Home Affairs. Under him, he had a chap called Chanda, who was an ex-ICS officer, and Chanda had got himself appointed as head of the PPPP, it was known as P4, Public Protection, Public Property Protection Police, who were charged with the job of arresting all bribe takers, all smugglers, all sorts of things. And the warrant, in fact, was signed by Chanda. So I said, give me the warrant. And I went up and I saw Nevin. And I said, look, what's this? Everything. He said, I don't know. And he said, Chanda has got some evidence against you for smuggling rice and receiving the proceeds of smuggling rice. And he said, apparently there's some evidence that you went and raped and murdered 13 Muslim women. And I said, oh, my God. I said, can't you do anything about it? He said, no, I can't really. He said, once it will have to go to the judicial minister. But he said, well, if it's a warrant of an arrest, you have to. So I said, bloody hell, I remember abusing a thing. Criminal, I knew bloody fool in Burmese. I had you up to. I went down and said, okay, boy, sir. Here's me in uniform with the Deputy Inspector General of Police, red tabs a lot. I said, Bo, you knew about this, you bugger, didn't you? He said, I did. What the hell did I say? I'm sorry. So Moitra said, please, sir, we've got to get you to Rangoon Prison. I said, look, I'm going home to Windermere Park. I was living with a financial commissioner. Because when my wife and kids came down, he spent the night there. And then when I had to ring him up to say, hey, they don't want me to go yet, I better stay with you, Kenneth. He said, yes, welcome. So I said, well, go and go get some kit. No, sir, please. Our orders are to get to the Rangoon Prison and report back once you're there, and it's got to be four to this. Please don't make any trouble. I said, don't worry about it. So I go to Rangoon Prison. I'm immediately taken to a political board full of communists. I'm handed over to the prison superintendent. And he said, okay, we've got this, we're expecting this. Where do I stay? And he said, well, we've got a compound, number 3 compound. I go there. And, God, they're all full of communists there. So anyway, this is now going on to 2 o'clock, hot as hell. I'm in a tunic, no time collar, it was sort of bush jacket, slacks, hat, battle, briefcase. Comes to about 3 o'clock, and the Indian warder's there. And they say, Saab, money up, so speaking. I'm so sorry, what is this, Saab? You come. I said, do you know? He said, yes, Saab, we knew from Kamawadi district. You were the police officer there. Oh, yeah. Don't worry, Saab, we'll be okay. So, anything, bath time. So we're all emptied out and we're going to have a bath. Well, I'm going to have a bath. The chaps have brought a 20-weight cross trough there with their, you know, little mugs in and soap. And as I'm looking at it, then two chaps said, hey, Carlisle, 2 university graduates. I said, what the hell are you doing here? Communists, man, communists, we've been locked up here. Have you got a change of clothes? No, don't worry, here you are. Here's a sarong, here's a vest, here's some soap. Well, have a bloody good bath. So I'm going to get my uniform on, clock it in my cell, which is only about, what, 8 by 5 or 8. And have a good bath. And then get into a sarong, and I'm feeling quite comfortable. I'm taking on the first floor of this ward. And then from the far corner, there's a shout again to me, Carlisle. It's Donald Ponder, bound to Grin. He was in SOE with me. I said, what are you doing here? How long have you been here? He said, oh, yeah. I said, what? For what? He said, preventive detention. I'm supposed to be a Karen terrorist. I said, anybody else here that you know? He said, well, have you met the two chaps downstairs? There's another chap on the other side of the cell. Okay, fine. He said, don't worry. Don't worry about the prison job. He said, the chap, the clerk in charge of the ward, has his own meals brought up, and he said they're special meals, and I shared with him. You come and share it with us as well. So the chap, the clerk, of course, he's got the key to all the cells there. He opens it up, come and join. That was, yeah, March the 20th. I'm in that compound for a month and a half. By which, in the meantime, these inmates start a riot. They capture some of the Indian warders. They capture one of the jailers, Burmese jailers. They're holding them hostage. I'm locked up in my cell upstairs. I didn't get all the freedom that, you know, I expected. I had to go out only at bath times, and when meals came, they shoved it through the old bars and whatever.
Anyway, you could hear this racket going outside. And
the leader was a very sort of militant communist. Wasn't going to give way, and he wasn't going to release that, and they warned them that the military was going to take over, and they would be shot at, and all this and all this. Next thing, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and